Tonight on Arena, Rodney Lee on The Unreal, his new TV series with the Pooka at its heart, and Debbie Godsell is inspired by harvest traditions in her new exhibition, Flail. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. You can also watch proceedings if you're so inclined. RTE.ie/arena is where you will see us on screen. Rodney Lee is an award-winning Dublin-based screenwriter and filmmaker. His latest project, The Unreal, is a four-part supernatural family drama, airs this month on RTE One and on the RTE Player. It blends elements of classic fantasy and mystery, a little bit of a Doctor Who feel off it, a little bit of the Twilight Zone feel off it, sometimes as well, I would say. And there are also some modern family issues in there, giving us this great mix of spooky adventure and family drama. I think I've said spooky more times in the last couple of days regarding this particular piece, Rodney, than I've said spooky in the last year. However, it's the time of year for that. Rodney Lee is with me in studio now, and delighted to have you here. And I suppose the thing that strikes me first, that this decision to put it out on RTE television are in and around Halloween. The Pooka is at the very heart of this story that you're telling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so, I mean, I suppose it's always occurred to me that there's such a great history of, like, Celtic mythology and Celtic myths and legends, and we never really see much production of it, you know, especially in modern television. And I mean, I know it would be kind of expensive to do a full-on thing. So, like, where we were coming from, we wanted to take these kind of ideas and do them in a modern way that we could achieve, you know, for a family audience.
Yeah, and you have a very modern Irish family heading off down on a holiday that none of them really want to go on, let's be honest.
No. Well, this is partly it. I mean, it was, you know, not to throw my own family under the bus, but I wanted to show a complicated family with, like, complicated relationships and dynamics, rather than just a very happy, jolly family. And again, like, for a family audience and for kids, I think we sometimes sugarcoat things a bit too much, and it's better to just be a bit, like, realistic and just say that, you know, life can be hard, but, you know, you will kind of succeed in the end.
Give us the essence of the Kelly family.
So we have Kevin is the boy. He's kind of in the doghouse in the family. He's about 12 years old.
He's in trouble at school.
This is it, exactly. He's not doing good at school. He's accused of, like, hitting a boy. So his phone has been suspended for this reason. His phone has been, confiscated.
He's been suspended
from school. He's been suspended, yeah. And then his mother is trying to juggle everything between family and work and trying to go on a holiday and get some quality time with the family as well.
And not tell work that she's on holiday.
Exactly.
She's working from home.
Which, again, modern working from home.
But do people that, say they're working from home and go elsewhere? Surely not.
I think they do. Well, I work from home and I'm
go
not saying anything
sometimes.
Else.
Yes. Okay.
And so then we have the dad as well, and he's going through a bit of a rough patch. He's kind of depressed, but he won't own up to the idea.
Yeah, he's spending a lot of time in bed, for sure.
Exactly, yeah.
Not just during this so-called holiday, this period out, but, you know, even before the events of Kevin having his difficulties at school. And then there's a teenage daughter.
And then we have the daughter as well. And she has a bit of a small following on Instagram, on social media, and she's trying to capitalise on that. And she's getting a bit sucked into that world of image and, you know.
Yeah, she does. She's going anywhere without the phone is just unthinkable. And there better be broadband in this holiday park that they go to, for both mum doing working from home, and indeed for the daughter. Katie is the daughter, isn't she? Played by Kate Brady, working from home. And into this mix comes a caretaker who's straight out of a Stephen King book in some ways, isn't she?
Definitely. So we have, she certainly seems very nice to begin with anyway.
Yeah.
She's a bit dotty, a bit eccentric, but friendly, you know. Mm. So I think we've all kind of met people like her down the country, you know, especially. And
there you go, alienating half the country.
Exactly.
There's some of them in the city as well.
That's true.
Cities.
And so she is certainly a very nice person. I think we always said, like, if the story had gone slightly differently, you could leave, you know, the family could have left and not realize that she does have a bit of an edge to her, a bit of some secrets herself, you know.
Yeah. So one of the things that happens here is that it's this old holiday park, and there are, you know, kind of areas of it that haven't been looked into for ages. And Kevin goes in a bit of a wander. And he finds a VHS along the way, which for modern audiences, children, was it the VHS that many of us watched as kids, which of course now is defunct.
Yeah.
Who has a video machine in their house today? Very few people.
That's it. I mean, I'm waiting for until like vinyl makes a comeback, because I have an attic full of old VHS tapes. So maybe someday, who knows?
Yeah. So this gathering of VHS tapes is based on real events in your household, Kevin. All right. Rodney, I'm calling you Kevin, because Kevin is the main character. Let us pick up on a point then where Kevin, the young character played by Senan Jennings, has come across this VHS and he needs to play it. He doesn't even know, well, what do you do with it? Mm-hmm. And when Mum and Dad explain, he decides that they should go up to the caretaker and ask her if she can help. The caretaker is played by Ali Nichiron here. But the first voice that we'll hear is Catherine McKiernan as Kevin, as Mrs. Kelly, as it were, as the mum here, asking the caretaker if she might be able to point them in the right direction regarding this VHS machine.
Hey, sorry to disturb you, but I was just wondering if you had any old VHS players in the holiday park.
Oh, I think there is one in the shed we use for storage. Huh. It's a bit of a hike up the mountain trail, but I can give you a key if you like.
That'd be great, thanks.
You're very welcome, Mr. Kelly. But first, a warning. That is not just a mountain. In the olden days, it was known as a fairy fort, home to the mischievous fairies of yore, who'd steal your soul as soon as they'd look at you. So make sure whatever else you do, you don't stray from the mountain trail, for fear a fairy might take you off and take you to the land of fairy, where they would devour your flesh and peel the skin off your body to make it into a coat.
Okay, that's plenty warning. Thank you. You're very kind.
There you go. Be careful who you ask to explain. I give just for simple directions, because you'll get that's Ali Nichiron there as the caretaker of this camp that the Kelly family go to in the new series. It's a young people's, I suppose, a family entertainment, really. It's going to go out at 10 past. One episode has gone out at 10 past 5, but it's on a Sunday afternoon. It's available on the player, and the other three episodes, Rodney Lee, writer, who's with me this evening, they'll be going out over the next three Sundays. But it is, and it's one of the things you do in some ways. Yeah, there's a little bit of scary stuff going on in some ways, but kids are probably able to, or young people are able to handle a lot more of that than we think sometimes.
Oh, I think so, yeah. I mean, even my nephew, Elijah, when he saw the trailer first, he actually had a nightmare about the Pooka, and I was thinking, oh no, have we made it too scary? But then having watched the whole thing, he said, oh, is the Pooka going to come back for series two?
Well, Elijah is ahead of the time with my final question this evening, which was going to be about season two. But let us come back to season two. This obviously you're writing, and I think you've collaborated on a number of one-off kids dramas, Rodney. But this was moving towards, it's an EBU scheme, isn't it, that has worked towards this series?
So the EBU was the funder of the short films that we did. So myself and Bonnie, the director, and David, producer, we'd worked on these short films. And they were very well received. They kind of got a lot of awards, recognition. And so, but they were great as just a kind of a calling card to say, look, this is the kind of tone we want to go for. This is the kind of, you know, the style, the quality of it. And it was very good. Then Bonnie had a good relationship with Suzanne Kelly in RTÉ Kids, because she'd work on other shows here. And then with Kamashoon Namion, they had like a sound and vision scheme.
Yeah.
And they jumped on board as well. So we were able to pitch kind of our idea for the show and take it from there.
That writing for a younger audience, I'm sure, has both its challenges and its joys. What is it that attracts you to writing for that younger age group?
Well, do you know, I mean, partly like it's tapping back into what would I have wanted to watch when I was a kid. And I mean, there was, of course, when I was young, there was so so many lesser options than there is nowadays.
Yeah, and if you missed it at 10 past 5 on a Sunday afternoon, tough luck unless you had the VHS running.
Exactly. So I mean, partly that's where I'm coming from, is just like what would I like to watch? But like writing for kids as well, you have to be, it's almost harder because you have to be very, very propulsive. You have to be, there can't be any fat on the bone. You know, it has to be all very tight, very logical.
Yeah, the episodes are effectively a half an hour.
That's it, exactly, you know. So in some ways, like say writing something for adults more, you might have like a 10-minute dialogue scene, or you know, where it's just comedic dialogue or something like that. But for kids, like, they will get bored and they will go, you know, they'll tune out and they'll turn to something else. So you really have to work a lot harder, I think, to keep their attention.
Yeah, because you have to keep it very tight.
Exactly.
And therefore a lot gets fitted into the half hour, to the television half hour. Let's listen to a second clip, which gives us a sense of the family dynamic, the beginning of the family dynamic here. Kevin seems to constantly land himself in trouble. Of course, he's kind of the reason that they're on this holiday, because he's been suspended from school, so they all have to decamp to deal with that. Senan Jennings plays the character of Kevin, but we'll also hear, once again, Catherine McKiernan as Mam. The dad is played by Joseph McGuckin, and Katie, the teenage sister, is played by Kate Brady. They come down in the morning to find that all the treats and sweets have been eating wrappers on the floor. There's only one major suspect here.
What?
Did you eat all of our treats last night?
I didn't do that.
You're such a liar.
I'm not.
These are supposed to be for all of us and last us all week.
I know that. It wasn't me. Why does no one in this family ever believe me?
You really don't care about anyone but yourself, do you? And you're lying now, just like you lied about hitting that boy at school.
Katie.
How many times? I didn't do that.
So why'd you get suspended then if you didn't do it?
Don't ask me. You're one to talk. You lie through your teeth every time you record another stupid Instagram video pretending to be someone cool when you're actually just a sad little loser.
Kevin, that's enough.
Dad, you believe me, don't you? I've had enough of this crap.
Kevin!
I mean cabbage.
He's not even...
There you go, Senan Jennings, who, by the way, Kevin had been told, I should have explained before, that he'd been told not to use the word that rhymes with rap, but to use cabbage instead, which we all do with kids. No, why did you use a different word beginning with C? So cabbage is his alternative there. But we get a sense in that short clip, you know, just the kind of the rough and tumble of family life and the rows that go on, and how, you know, the lashing out at each other kind of can happen very quickly.
That's it, yeah. I mean, partly I think, again, what I wanted to show with the TV show is just a slightly more realistic view of family life and family dynamics, you know. Because again, like say when I was young, it would have been a lot more sanitized, the kind of depiction of family and kids.
Yeah,
and
the Brady Bunch type of thing. Everything was happy, sitcom, happy clappy. Yeah.
And you do kind of go, you know, as entertaining as that is, that it's, you don't quite see yourself on screen. And even, you know, nowadays there's so many American imports, you know, especially for kids. And it's culturally, it's a bit different. So I do think it's important to show kind of Irish kids themselves on screen to a certain extent.
Yeah, and the other thing is with the teenage daughter in particular, there is this whole section around how much she's using her phone, and she's posting to her followers at one point, and the Ali Nahiran character says, why is she speaking with an American accent? You know, and you get that sense of,
yes,
we've all heard that. Why are those young ones speaking with American accents? Let's have a listen to another clip which touches on where it goes to, where the series goes to. We get some of the mother's problems, we certainly get the teenage problems, we get the son, Kevin, struggling with his particular situation, but the dad is having his own worries as well, because he's out of work, he's been spending a lot of time in bed, and he doesn't seem to be able to face up to that at all. Catherine McKiernan as the mother here, talking to dad, played by Joseph McGuckin, about his relationship with Kevin.
Will you go out and talk to him?
He's grand.
I just think maybe he's acting up because you two don't spend much time together these days.
Look, I'm just having a bit of a hard time at the minute. How would you feel if you were fired from your job?
I'm not having a go, but They started before they let you go.
What are you talking about?
You have to admit, you're not yourself. You're sleeping more. You barely spend any time with me or the kids. Tom, it's okay if you're feeling depressed.
Okay, look, if it's that important to you, I'll go out and I'll talk to Kevin. Okay? Cool.
He'll come round eventually.
There you go. And Katie Brady's the final voice. Or Kate Brady's the final voice we heard there as the character of Katie. But before that, Mum and Dad in the Kelly family from the series The Unreal, Joseph McGuckin and Catherine McKiernan. And Rodney Lee, writer of the series, is with me in studio this evening. There is that balance between, and it has to be, like, there's a lot of fun in this. The clips we have do give a sense of it's kind of the more serious side of things, particularly those second two clips, Rodney. And that balance is important, that you're not beating people over the head with a message.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, because this is I think there's room in a good story for both kind of having, you know, talking about some real life issues and just primarily telling an entertaining story. And with good characters and good storytelling. But I think in terms of the mental illness, like, again, it does go back to when I was young. Like, I did have in my household, there was some depression. And as a kid, you are just kind of confused because no one's really talking about it. And I mean, I do think nowadays it's a bit better. It's improved. But certainly if I saw something like this when I was 10 years old, I think I would have got a lot of comfort from it. You know, just that idea that, like, other people have gone through what you're going through and you're not sort of alone, you know.
And it's all right to talk about it. You don't,
exactly.
You don't have to bury it. And I do have to say one of the important things here, one of the joyous things is it revisits the 1980s in very particular ways, and 1980s television, which will bring lots of people back to their childhood and watching those programmes in the afternoon when you only had one chance to see them. They weren't available to stream forever and a day. There is a sense at the end of season one, at the end of the four episodes, that there is a season two. Is that already there, Rodney?
It's not there yet, but fingers crossed, you know, if it gets a good reception, then it would happen. We certainly have a lot of ideas about where it would go.
Where it could go, yeah. No, it had a sense so that, okay, that there were plenty of places it could move off to. Thanks for coming in to us this evening, Rodney. And all of the episodes of The Unreal are available on the RTE player now. Episode one was last Sunday. You can pick up on episode two this Sunday. Imagine the whole family could sit down together and watch it over four separate Sunday afternoons at 5:10.
The last one is on Bank Holiday Monday.
And the last one is on Bank Holiday Monday. So it's perfect. The Pooka has a real Halloween feel to
exactly
it as well. Thanks for coming in to us, Rodney.
Thank you.
Now, these days, with the national conversation seemingly so concentrated, for good or ill, on the new Irish and our immigrant population, it's interesting to think a little more about the original makeup of Ireland pre-independence and the parallel traditions of Catholic and Protestant. This is the subject matter of Flail, an exhibition at the Source Gallery in Thurles from artist Debbie Godsell. This is the second part of an exploration that Debbie undertook into Protestant traditions in Ireland. Questions she asked about how a lot of these traditions and stories are shrouded in silence. Flail is a response to a detailed photographic archive that Debbie created of Protestant traditions, particularly in and around the whole idea of harvest. And it's a reaction to what she found and the reasons that these traditions have been left to disappear. Delighted that Debbie Godsell joins us this evening from our Cork studio. I believe, Debbie, that the starting point for this whole exploration of Protestant traditions around harvest in particular comes from the Apicio, rather dubious saying, let's be honest, if your butter doesn't churn or your eggs don't lay, then it's probably the fault of a local witch or hag or Protestant woman. Delightful, eh?
Yeah, I guess during COVID I was poking around, like most people, around podcasts and doing a bit of research. So I stumbled on the National Folklore Collection, who have a great archive. And there were plenty of stories about Protestants, I think around 4,000 actually. And a lot of them were had this sort of flavour. So if you chase a Protestant woman, she might turn into a hare. If your butter isn't churning or your hens aren't laying, there might be some sort of disruption in the locality, something unusual. And as you said, that could be the fault of a hag or even a Protestant woman. So I was very taken aback by those stories.
Yeah, kind of. Yeah. It kind of stops you in your tracks when you see it written down in black and white. And the book that you came across that this all led you to, I think, was Deirdre Nuttall's book, a book called Different and the Same. Explain to me a little bit about that and how it set you off on other tracks.
So while I was listening to the National Folklore podcast, which is an amazing resource, I heard Deirdre being interviewed about her book. And I went then straight away and I purchased the book. And it's beautifully, it's got some lovely chapters, stories of the land, stories of origin, stories of love and marriage. And I'm from a Church of Ireland background myself. And actually reading her book, I learned a lot about my own heritage that I actually didn't know myself. So I contacted Deirdre out of the blue and I asked her, would she be interested in mentoring me? Because I wanted to almost complement her book and make a sort of a visual version of it in a way. So after chatting with Deirdre, we decided that I would go up to the folklore collection and read her transcripts and interviews with members of the Church of Ireland. And the one tradition that really stood out, that everyone spoke about really happily, was the tradition of the Harvest Thanksgiving. So when I was a child, it was something that I used to really enjoy. It would be in our local church in St. Mary's in Passage West every year, where the church was festooned with sheaves and hydrangea and local produce, turnips, apples all along the sides and all over the communion table. And this was a tradition that I thought happened in every church in Ireland.
Yeah, Catholic and Protestant churches.
Yeah, I didn't realise it was a custom that was unique to the Church of Ireland. So I guess that was my in to the project.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And have you found reasons why a harvest seems to be something that was very concentrated within the Protestant faith? And you're saying specifically Church of Ireland there. Why specifically it was concentrated there rather than across other denominations?
Well, I guess, are you talking about the harvest tradition?
Yeah, the whole
the Thanksgiving
idea.
Yeah,
I mean, it comes with, like most Christian festivities, it has a pagan origin. But why did it catch, if you like, within the Protestant faith, do you think, as opposed to the Catholic faith in Ireland?
Well, you know, obviously it has a strong, long history, and it's harvest Thanksgiving is something that also happened in biblical terms. But the tradition itself started in England in 1843, where this Reverend Stephen Hawker decided that he would bring the harvest celebrations into the church. So I think this came from Lammas, which would be an Anglo-Saxon tradition, and where there would have been loads of festivities, lots of drinking maybe, but people would have built sheaves, buried sheaves on the land to bring sort of good luck for the coming year, for the coming harvest, or put baked bread along the farm sheds for good luck as well. So this really took off in Victorian England. They went mad for it. It's still huge over there. And it didn't come to Ireland till 1899. So there was a big gap, I think 60-year gap, probably to do with the fact that our harvest was going in the wrong direction.
Yeah, obviously we're in and around, or we're just after famine times
exactly.
there in Ireland, so that may have had a bearing on all of this. I want to look at some of the specific images within the exhibition, if I could, Debbie. We've just been talking about the children's series that has the puka at the very heart of it. And it did strike me that the set of images that you have that make up a piece called Protesters.
Yeah, they are scary.
Yeah, it has. They all have, to a large extent, there's a feeling of the puka of many of the heads that we see here. Maybe you just explain the images to us. We've tweeted it, by the way, on at RTE Arena if you want to see it.
So the work is 15 images, 15 large screen prints of these heads that I made. So they all started off as little sculptures. And I decided that drawing on elements of folk drama where you use music and costume and sort of play acting to tell stories of local identity, I decided that I was going to make my ancestors. Hmm. So the first Godsells came to Ireland in 1620. They were Amos, John and James. And their voices are actually recorded in the Trinity Depositions.
What are the Trinity Depositions? Explain those to us.
It's a really wonderful archive in Trinity where there was one of the many, many massacres in Ireland, the Protestant testimonies were collected at the time and they were sort of used later on by Cromwell to justify further invasions of Ireland. But anyway, my ancestors were complaining of their cattle being taken and their, the farms being ransacked, and they were speaking about maybe other members that had converted to Catholicism. So, you know, I guess it was looking at dark histories, dark family histories. So I just decided to kind of face them. I wanted to meet them. So I made them. I made them of straw. I baked them. I used fabric and I then enlarged them. So they're massive.
Yeah.
And I think by enlarging them, they became sort of really monstrous, but also they became quite absurd and very comical as well.
Yeah, all of those qualities are in there, as you say, the comical, the absurd and the quite frightening at times as well.
And I think by almost meeting them, they then became not scary.
Yeah.
You know, I was able to look at that sort of contested history and make peace with it in a way.
Yeah. And the history of, particularly of, I suppose, the oral tradition that we often talk about within Ireland in general, of how stories are passed on and how stories are spoken of. You talk about quietism within the Protestant faith. Explain what you mean by that within the Protestant tradition and community.
There's a text that I use in the exhibition called, and it just says, "Don't make a fuss." And that would have been something that I would have grown up with, which is, you know, the sort of keep the head down, don't make a fuss, don't draw any attention to yourself. And I think that was something that happened amongst the Church of Ireland post-independence. They became quite inward looking and they just became quiet as a minority group, I think.
And how did class play into that, do you think?
I think there had to be a lot of sort of identity work done after independence. You know, you hear stories about Protestants who suddenly were being called English by their neighbours, even though they'd been here for hundreds of years. Mm. So there was lots and lots of difficulties around identity. And I suppose there's this perceived position of privilege, if that's what you mean by class as
well.
Yeah,
I suppose we're not really talking about the ascendancy in terms of many of these people. We're talking about, for want of a better phrase, the ordinary man and woman on the street.
Yeah, so there were plenty of poor Protestants and working class Protestants, people who would have come over as servants and things like that. But I think the general belief was, we were all from the big house or members of the ascendancy or, you know, people used to laugh at me and call me the landed gentry. You know, it's funny, but I think those notions kind of passed down. And I wanted to see, were they still around?
And they were or weren't?
They are.
I guessed as
much. But they're humorous. I don't think, you know, they're just unconscious prejudices. I don't think people genuinely mean it anymore.
Yeah. I want to tweet another image if I can. This is Harvest Thanksgiving. And again, it kind of links in with our first item this evening in that we were talking about harking back to the 1980s and to old memories.
Yeah.
This is a classic, I suppose, harvest still life. You know, lots of fruit and veg, and there's a turtle on there. There's some furs on there as well. but in the midst of it all, Angel Delight.
Yeah.
And is it marrow fat peas that I can see on the other side of the pineapple there?
Yeah.
Tell me a little bit. And there are steak and kidney pies or whatever over to the, and Heinz beans, I think, over there as well. Tell us a little bit about the ideas in that particular image at RTE Arena to have a look.
Yeah, there's a lot going on in that piece. And it was in the RHA annual exhibition during the summer. So I drew in a lot of things. I drew in our colonial history. That would have been maybe the pineapple, which would have been seen as a sort of a posh thing to have on your table. And I the Marifat peas and all those sort of packaged goods. So a lot of the Harvest Thanksgivings, they collect food and they donate them to food banks afterwards. So a lot of the produce that I saw in the boxes were these kind of Marifat peas and tins of, you know, steak and Angel Delight, which is something I used to absolutely love as a child, even though back then it was full of plenty of E numbers, I think. It's not the same now.
But we didn't know what numbers were.
We didn't, and it was yum anyway.
Exactly.
And then there's lots of mouldy bread, so I'm kind of turning the harvest thing upside down. I noticed during a lot of the services that there was this sort of worry about natural disaster and where we were going with our climate change and things like that. So I guess it's like almost an apocalyptic harvest Thanksgiving in a way.
One other piece I'd like to tweet is the Tower of Kneelers. Again, we'll tweet this up on @RTE Arena. I don't know how tall this particular tower is, but it's made up of kneelers from Protestant churches, some of them with images on them, some of them just in their almost raw kneeler form.
Yeah, that's right. So I was lucky enough to borrow some church kneelers from Castle Ventry Church in Clonakilty, who were very generous to do that. And then I made some myself as well. So the ones I made are from repurposed fabric and they've all sorts of different screen printed images on it. And so I built them up into this sort of tottering round tower. And I guess I was thinking about the knowledge gap. So I had discovered during my research that Protestant school children around the 40s generally used a history book by a woman called Dora Casserly, which sort of skirted around, the darker aspects of history and looked a lot at myth and legend and round towers and, you know, the sort of positive parts of Protestant history, and that Catholic children were reading a different history book, which was more nationalistic, I suppose. So I thought that was really interesting that, and it probably explained a lot to me as well why I wasn't even fully aware of my own history. I mean, in school, we probably did a lot of European history. I didn't even know who Cromwell was until, I was much older. So, and I think the fact that history isn't studied a lot in schools these days might be problematic for the future. I just think it's really important that you need to understand the past.
I think a lot of people might agree with you on that. But as you're saying there, be careful that you're not just getting one version of history, no matter what that version is.
Yeah, you need to read all the books.
Get all the histories that you can.
Definitely, yeah.
Debbie, thanks so much for joining us this evening and best of luck with the exhibition. That's Debbie Godsell. The exhibition is called Flail. It's at the Source Arts Centre in Thurles in County Tipperary and it's there until Saturday the 19th of October. You can find out more on the Source website. Now, when an Irish Times review describes a poetry collection as pleasingly spiky, it suggests a rich and fun experience for readers. That is how Old Friends, latest collection of poetry from Irish language poet Afric Mackay, is described. And indeed, it is just that, playful and warm, little sting in the tail the odd time, it has to be said, though, as well. Afric herself describes it as a celebration of friendship, something she cherishes as she makes her way in the world. Afric is assistant editor of On Goom, the Irish language poetry editor at Stinging Fly magazine and the Dublin literary journal Gorse. Old Friends will be launched tomorrow evening, but we're delighted to have Afric Mackay in studio with us this evening. Old Friends, how important is friendship to this collection, I suppose, most importantly, Afric, but it clearly is something that is very important to you if you're going to give that title to a collection.
It's very important to me. I think it's important to me for three reasons, really. When I was quite young, my parents died, and I remember how much my friends mattered at that time.
You were in your teens, I think, were you?
I was 19 and 21, yeah. So Not very young, but
yeah,
young enough.
Yeah, young to lose your parents.
Certainly old enough to remember how kind people were around that time. That's one thing. I think another thing is if you don't have children, and if you're not lucky enough, I suppose, to have brought a child or brought life into the world, you'd naturally lean on your friends a little bit more. So there are two reasons. Another reason is that I'm the youngest of seven. And it was definitely a way of pushing myself into my own shape. Just having my own set of friends was a way of finding my freedom.
And establishing your own identity outside of the family.
I think we'd all agree that we did that, every one of us.
And what kind of friend are you? I have to tell this person the truth type of friend? Or are you, I won't say anything because if I say anything, we'll have an enormous row.
I think I strike an unhealthy balance there. Neither one nor the other.
Yeah, well, I guess I'm picking
case
up on
by
the
case.
Yeah, I suppose, yeah, fair enough. But I'm picking up on the idea that the Irish Times did mention this idea of spiky. You do kind of, it's not that you have a go, but you're not pulling your punches. Sometimes you kind of are saying what you feel about things that have happened in the past.
I hope so. I mean, it's a vindictive little book in a way, but I think it's important to take a swipe at yourself and to take a swipe at the poetry world, and to remember that, I mean, an awful lot of this book is talking shop and it's talking about the poetry scene. And I probably, if I were more mature, wouldn't do that, because it's not very interesting for other people. But I felt I had to get it out of my system.
And Tá na dántaglar scríofa agus in Gaeilge, as Gaeilge. Agus an sin that the translations are in English, not from you, but from David Wheatley.
Sin agadé.
Now, abair dám fuin Gaeilge ar dús, ní as an Gaeltacht tú ar chur a bit.
I mál eatlia tógach. Misha ach Erin Spigel a rogu me.
Ah, right.
Agus that's streamer nervy. Misha hovely in the that's streamer in the ears.
Right. So you came up to Dublin at 12. But so was Irish not the first tongue then? Mother tongue.
When I was even younger, when I was two, I was only two when I moved.
Oh,
to
right.
Dublin.
Right. Sorry.
And my parents were from Belfast and from Cavan. Now, my father had fluent Irish, but
yeah.
my mother had plenty of Irish, but maybe not as much as my father. And I think we grew up speaking both, but we spoke more English, more English than Irish, really, at home.
So how big a decision and how difficult a decision was it to you to write your poems, as Gaeilge, or was that the way they came out? They forced themselves out in Irish. They weren't prepared to be put into English in your mouth.
I think that's the only way to put it. I had no choice. I felt like I had no choice. And my father wrote in Irish, so I might have been just trying to impress him.
Right, yeah. So there was a touch of that at play. Let us talk about, because I'm going to get you to read it, and to read David Wheatley's translation as well, Go Gone Raw. A little bit of the background to this and what's going on in your mind.
Okay, I mean, I meant it in a light way, really, but it's just a poem about how when men weary of women, and I am generalising, but when men weary of women, they tend to forget that they were the ones to pursue the women in the first place. So I think that's the point of it.
So go, gone, go, unnecessary lie is how it translates.
But it's also, I suppose, making the point that you can make a friend of an old love.
Oh,
it can
right.
be done.
Okay, well, let's have a listen to it then. So leithi tú as Gaeilge ar dús agus an sin, the translation in English afterwards.
Cinnte gur maith. Go, gan go. Blad na blaime ir na faime ceart ar nádúir. Mas le táile sop na gorge súle náirte cosca. Ach a chara, os bui an tadra, ná sein bavraig, an fiach, an jarraga. And David Wheatley's translation, Unnecessary Lie. A man of action, a red flower flash is what our natures demand. A poor fee, friendship's stalk and hope forbidden. But, friend, since it's late in the day, don't deny it would be a lie. The hunt, the blush.
And that is Afric Mochay, the Shandon Go Gon Gra, and in its translated form by David Wheatley, Unnecessary Lie. And it has all of those things present that you spoke about a little bit beforehand, Afric. There clearly is a great still warmth for the particular person. But
there's never one person, though. I think that's what people forget. So
it's not. This isn't a particular. Because I was going to ask you: is there a particular person who would read this and say, "Oh, I recognise myself"?
Oh, at least one.
At least. but it is also.
Hopefully,
I'll take your several people point then. To these several people, it is both slightly ticking them off, but also remembering the warmth of the relationship that. If there was no warmth there, it wouldn't have blossomed in the first place.
I would like to think so. Thank you.
And how important is it for you to have that? You know, because it's easy to just give this one-sided, one part of the story. You know, they say if in a relationship there are at least three versions of the story, his, hers, and then something in the middle that's probably the truth. How important is it to have all those aspects present?
Very. Very. I'm not sure if I managed to accomplish that, but that is, I suppose, that's the job to see it
from
every
angle. Yeah, you've said that the writing in Irish was kind of that's how it had to come out, but there is a little bit of I think shyness, or are you slightly reticent or slightly anxious about the writing at Oscuiliga?
I am, of course. I'm not a native speaker, and I do work through Irish every day.
Mm.
But you'll never, I think at least, you'll never really catch up in a native speaker. So that makes me wonder, should I be writing poetry in Irish at all? But every writer has his
yes.
or her.
And yet you don't do the translations. You mean you could translate it. Why have you left that? And in this case, it's David Wheatley who does all of them for you. Why have you left that in somebody else's hand?
Because he's far better. And also, I think because, I mean, Irish and English could never play nicely together. It's foolish to expect them to play nicely together. So
why would you think they wouldn't play nicely together?
Because there are two different thought worlds there, and there are two souls vibrating at different frequencies, because in part at least because of their different histories. So it's better, I think, to hand your poems over and to have a brilliant poet like David Wheatley.
But clearly your soul is beating to the Irish beat. That's the drum that it's listening to.
It is. It is. I mean, it's hard to avoid the English all around me, but yes.
It beats louder or faster perhaps for the Irish language. Inde is the second poem that I want you to read, which translates as yesterday. Is that, it's an old version of the word inye, is it?
That's it, exactly. You're one of the few people to pick up on that, thank you. It is because I wanted it to seem like a very long ago yesterday.
So an ancient feel.
Yeah, more yesterday than just yesterday.
Go ahead. Go ahead and read it first. Do you think we need to know anything other than this is a long ago yesterday?
No, I don't think so.
Right.
I suppose you need to know that I will mention Christmas, and I'm sorry for that.
That's okay. We're getting there nearly.
La, la nolig, shuk erim la chap, fecum tri chovran glina, rose shingle einric bon. Lovlin in you and ruds nach fager, wigni na nye and blaw in treke. Yesterday, Christmas day and frost round the flower base, through it lassie haze I see a lone white rose. Today the impossible is close and lonelier than yesterday. is the bloom that goes.
And that's the poem Yesterday, a translation by David Wheatley of Afric Mackay's poem Inye, which is part of her current collection, Old Friends. There's a sadness, there's a kind of a sense of loss within that, Afric, for me.
There should be. I'm glad. There should. I think that we things press on us at Christmas in particular. So any sense of loss at all will hurt more at that time.
At that particular time of year. I'm wondering about, you know, often within a poet's armoury is precisely that, some armour, some language or some images that, not that they're hiding behind, but that will allow them to say something that perhaps, to say it straight in blank prose to somebody, it's too blunt or something like that. Not that you're hiding, but that you can say things that you couldn't say. When you add the Irish language into that, does that give you an extra layer of armour, or how would you describe that use of the Irish language?
That's interesting. I suppose as a dictionary poet, you can make a lot of false steps. You can carry the wrong nuance very easily. So it's hard for me to be precise in English. In Irish, no, I mean, of course.
There's a Freudian slip if ever there was one.
Quite hard in English too, it seems. But you're asking, is poetry a way of hiding?
No, I'm not really asking, is it a way of hiding? But is it a way of saying things that you can't say out loud in a straightforward
way?
Yeah.
Yes, it is.
It is that.
It is. Although I think very often what you're saying seems very clear to you, and maybe other people don't.
Let's finish up with Don Yar, our short poem, which is part of the sequence. It's part of the Old Friends sequence. The sequence Old Friends is dedicated to several friends along the way, and then we get Don Yar.
We do. And actually, it's a poem about what poetry can and can't do. I mean, it's short poems blow away, really. So, Don Gyar. Skelpini shandarish a hug to Erma over. Snahidi, la schnachte, pohini an alle. An knas eager viagut an rin is fa manoire. Ahig mochri is shig. Bich brah ek il ergoire. Short poem. The splinters of an old door you called my subjects, needles and snow, little breath puffs. You'd sensitive skin, a point and cause of my shame, tall man of my heart within, may tears check our laughter.
Short poem, Ardon Yar, there from Afric Mackay. For Dahi, was Dahi the man who went off and told you that your splinters of an old door were inspiring you into poetry?
He was not. I don't think anyone ever said it at all. But I did want to talk about exactly what you were saying, what poetry can do. And I mean, splinters and needles and little breath puffs really.
Absolutely.
Aren't
they have their uses. Listen, thanks so much for coming into us, Afric. That's Afric Mackay
and
Old Friends, Poems in Irish by Afric Mackay, translated by David Wheatley, is published by Gallery Press, and it is available in all good bookshops now, and some other ones as well, as they say. That is our lot for this Wednesday? I think it is Wednesday evening. I'll have a go. I can't find my page with people's names on them. Here we go. Leah Murphy researched the programme this evening. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator. Tommy O'Sullivan was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Pauline McNamara. Yay, a full house. That's great. Go home and go to bed now. I will be back with you tomorrow night, 7 o'clock, here on RTE Radio 1. John Crean will be with you after the news.